Edger thing.
Back in 1936, us truck drivers did our own rating. It was a 50-cent minimum, and really there was first, second, and third class. We would pick up a shipment and deliver it. We had a one-sheet tariff that gave us the first, second, and third class rates. We'd do our own extension on it and collect the money. Another thing that I just recall was that we would start delivering freight about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I would deliver in Ubley, Ruth, Minden City, Deckerville, and be in Sandusky for breakfast, delivering all of this freight at the store's doors before they were open. Of course, you couldn't do it when it was raining. And then in the afternoon, on the way back from Port Huron, stop in and get the bill signed and collect the money. And I never remember a Blair Transit Company paying a claim for a loss of one piece of freight. You couldn't do that today because someone would be following behind with a truck picking up everything you delivered.
Mm-hmm. It was a system of trust then.
That's exactly the way it was. And in those days, of course, we hauled the meat and the ice cream and the bread and all these things that were delivered now, usually by the person that makes the product. And the storekeepers were right out to assist you in getting the merchandise and getting it in their store and ready to sell. It's a whole different world today than it was delivering freight then.
Did the trucking companies lose significant sales when these meat manufacturers and the like went into delivering their own material?
Oh, naturally it was a loss, but you know, there's always something else to take its place. I know that we would bring orders in from a traveling salesman who would deliver them to our offices because our truck mail service was much, much better than the postal service. We would deliver those orders in Detroit or in Saginaw or in Bay City the following morning and go back to the same places later that day and pick up the orders filled and deliver them back to them that same afternoon or the following day, depending upon the distance away from the home terminal.
Your service then was better than the postal service.
Really, it was. They would they relied on us to deliver their orders and get them filled and pick it up and take it back to the customer. Although I never did it myself, I know of a fellow that run a truck line, a single truck operation, and he would actually go in and survey the grocery store's shelves, write down what they needed, come into Saginaw and go to Simon's Brothers or G.A. Alderton Company or Lee and Katy and have those orders filled and take them back in the afternoon and deliver to those stores.
I wondered myself, Mr. Hickey, about driver requirements at that particular time when you originally came into trucking. Was there any other than a normal driver's license? I know now a driver must have a chauffeur's license. I think there's several other requirements.
We had to have a chauffeur's license, as I recall it. But you didn't have the restrictions on you that you have today, in that you had to have to pass a physical once each 3 years, and your hearing has to be so-so, and your eyesight 20/20, either with glasses, correction by glasses. I guess in those days they said you had to have a weak mind and a strong back, and that made you a truck driver. Of course, the image of the truck driver at that time was pretty low, and I don't know yet to this day why everybody looked down on the truck driver, but they did. And I'll tell you today that a professional truck driver is a professional. He has to get out and do his particular thing, if you want to use that terminology, in a very, very competitive, yes, very highly competitive industry, because there are many, many more applicants than there are jobs of those that want to get into truck driving.
I imagine at times it could be dangerous, too, being that a driver is on the road as much as they are.
Well, again, of course, there are laws that govern what we can do. And a company like ours, we abide by the law. But there is the gray market driver, or whatever you want to term him, the parasite, who is hauling something up and down the road, even though there is no name on either the tractor or trailer. He is the individual that will drive as long as he can keep his eyelids up, and sometimes longer. He is the individual that brings a bad name to our industry because he's a cheat. Subsequently ends up in a disastrous accident, and then everybody points the finger at the tractor-trailer combination that caused a serious accident. And yet those are a very, very small percentage of the trucks on the road. The major truck lines have the rules and regulations. They have safety departments. They have safety engineers out on the road. And they don't try to circumvent the law by using the back roads like these other individuals do. We're pretty much on the up and up. As I say, as a professional truck driver, and people should be looking up to them instead of looking down on them.
Back in earlier years, was that quite a prevalent factor? Like Wildcat-type truckers that did their own business on the side?
Still is.
Very more so, less so, or about the same?
I would imagine the percentage stays about the same, which of course makes many more of them, but I wouldn't say the percentage has changed.
Similar to this line of thinking, I read an article recently about a problem of truck hijacking in the larger areas and larger cities. Yeah. As Great Lakes, or of course the earlier two companies that made up Great Lakes, had any problems along those lines in this area?
Well, I'll go back in history a little bit on that. I can think of a case where the Doyle Freight Lines lost a new pickup and delivery truck that was bought here in Saginaw, Michigan from Draper Chevrolet and taken to Chicago and was stolen from the property and has never been found. Now, that was the loss of a vehicle, but earlier I had mentioned where we purchased ACE Freight Incorporated and started serving the New York area along with Boston and complete coverage of those states. We served that area for about 2 years and had 5 loads hijacked or lost. 3 of the loads, as I recall, were tires originating in the Akron, Ohio area. And of course, tires would be one item easily disposed of. But I have a chuckle about another one.
What year was that, if I can interrupt?
That would have been in 1969, 1970, 2 years. The same time when we were serving the Boston area, we started to haul double bottom units on the New York Thruway from Ripley, New York to the staging area, which was about 17 miles outside of Boston. And the driver that took the load in dropped the rear trailer at the staging area and went on to the terminal with the lead trailer. And the next morning, the terminal sent out a man to pick up the trailer that was left at the staging area, and it was gone. It had a load of beer on it. And I guess the party isn't over yet, because we've never found the trailer.
A whole load.
Yeah, a load of beer.
That was
so those things do happen. And there's been a lot of corrective steps taken in the industry of late to try and offset some of this terrific hijacking, which is so prevalent in the New York area.
What year was that big beer heist?
That would have also been in 1969. Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, we only served that area for about 2 years. As I say, lost five loads in 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Was that a very important factor years back, earlier years of trucking? It would have seemed like then it would have been maybe easier to hijack and not be caught.
No, I don't recall of it. You had a certain amount of theft, but we think over the years that it has been proven that the biggest majority of your thefts are internal thefts by people working on the dock and getting in cahoots, if I can use that terminology, with a driver that's leaving the property, and they'll put something additional on the unit and then meet afterwards. We had this happen in Detroit just 2 or 3 years ago. But we were aware something was going on, and actually watched these dock people load TVs on a trailer with a driver that was going out to make deliveries in the city of Detroit, and then followed them not very many blocks, where they were met with some friends of theirs driving a Hertz or an Avis rental truck, and they backed up to the trailer and proceeded to transfer the TVs, and of course was caught. But you see, this was an internal thing. It started with people working for us on our Detroit dock. And so these things, of course, do go on, and probably every day. All you can do is try and combat it as best you can.
I wonder, too, since Great Lakes and the other two companies, Doyle and Blair, were functioning during the war years, what effect did the war, World War II, say, have on the trucking industry? Did it drain people from drivers, or was there a significant defense?
Well, it was tough. It was tough going at that time, and I guess fortunately, Blair and Doyle were about 100% Chevrolet powered.
Tractor wise?
Yes. Subsequently, it certainly assisted them in keeping their equipment in reasonably good shape. Not really, because we were adjacent to Flint where the trucks were manufactured, but really you could go to a scrap yard and actually buy Chevrolet parts and put them on a vehicle, and they would function. It was a real test, and of course at that time, much differently than we do now, vehicles were completely torn down and reconditioned and put back together and painted and retained for 9 and 10 years. Today our goal is that we'll take a highway tractor and run it 3 years on the road and 1 year in the city and dispose of it.
For your
For a line haul tractor. Of course, in those days, if you got 50,000 miles a year on a line haul tractor, that was good, because basically you didn't go anywhere. I meant short haul. Where today, where we have the long haul, we are... Our goal is 150,000 miles a year per vehicle, and 3 years on the highway, that's 450,000 miles, and the balance of maybe around a year in city pickup and delivery, and you can kiss it goodbye.
As opposed to back when you first started, how many miles did they try to get out of a unit then?
We were probably, of all the years we had it, we might get 200,000 miles on it in 8 or 9 years. You'd run 3 or 4 years on the road, which would maybe be upwards of 200,000, and then in city pickup and delivery for 2 or 3 or 4 years. But cities weren't near as large as they are now, and you just didn't put the miles on.
Right.
We kept trailers 10 years then, and now we keep trailers 5 years.
Mm-hmm. The war then didn't have an effect on the company?
Well, it had a lot of effect upon the company. I think it was, as I say, they were tough years to operate because you didn't get any new equipment. You had to do with what you had, and of course, the volume of business was there because the wartime economy brought it on. I remember we hauled Dow magnesium from the Dow plant that was built in Marysville, Michigan, over to the Dow plant in Midland, Michigan, and they gave Blair Transit Company 50 loads a week to haul. Well, that was a pretty big order for a small company. And we did all of it on weekends. And we got Mr. Blair, our president, to drive truck, and Tom Knox, who was general manager of Doyle Freight Lines, to drive truck, and my brother-in-law, who was a farmer, and anybody else we could get
to
drive trucks on weekends. And we moved those 50 loads a week for a good many weeks with little or no problem.
So you tried to take on the 50 loads in addition to your normal?
We did take it on. It wasn't any question. We took it on, and it paid well. It was quick load and quick unload, so it didn't tie up the equipment, you know, so that you couldn't function again on Monday morning.
Right.
You went to Marysville and you got loaded in 15 or 20 minutes and went to Midland and got unloaded in 15 or 20 minutes and you freed your equipment and made money on it.
Were there fixed governmental rates when you first started out and during the war years and say now? Or were they set pretty much by the trucking firms themselves? I imagine during the war they were...
No, there was published rates. Now, I don't know how well they were controlled. And I don't remember right now when the rate bureaus and the enforcement agencies really came into being. I would say this happened in the late 30s, but I wouldn't know the exact year. I know in 1935, which was just prior to my time, but I've heard it mentioned so many times, that the Interstate Commerce Commission came along and companies got what they call grandfather rights. This was when they first issued a certificate.
The government,
to the carrier. And really, anybody that had been real smart in those days and wanted to have a large territory to serve, he could have named anything he wanted, and he would have gotten that as grandfather rights. And some carriers did.
It was a kind of monopoly then.
But they didn't realize at that time that they could have went way beyond the boundaries they were then serving.
Mm-hmm.
They could have went, I think, all the way to the West Coast if they'd wanted to, but I don't know of anybody that did. But that's when the Interstate Commerce Commission was formed and took over, and that's when regulation first started. Now, whether that included rates or not, I don't recall.
Sometime during the 30s, eh?
But in the late 30s, you're definitely into full regulation.
Mm-hmm. And the government has controlled and maintained the rates
ever since.
Was there any reduction in rates, say, during the war, when the country was doing a significant amount of belt tightening for the war effort?
Not any that I recall, but there are actually reductions of rates going on all the time, even though we have inflation today, but there are factors involved. If you've got a good one-way movement, Saginaw to Detroit, for example, and you're coming home empty, it might be well, and companies have done this, to put in what they call a commodity rate and cut the rate to attract business from Detroit to Saginaw in order to have a load on the vehicle coming home. I always said that any type of a load that would pay anything was better than dust on the floor.
Right.
Because if you just got enough to pay for your fuel, it's a factor.
Right.
So you have that type of rate thing rate making going on even in the industry today, because as new plants come about in new locations and the flow of traffic, you adjust yourself to it. And of course, again, where there's large volumes of freight, where you could load many loads each day, then of course you're hungry for that type of freight, and you will put in a rate to handle it, because this is where volume pays off. Mm-hmm. It's just like volume paying off for a large grocery store. It isn't that he makes a penny on an item and he only sells a very few items a day. It is he makes a penny on all the items and he sells several thousand items per day, so they make their money that way. The same thing is true in our industry.
Was there, do you remember at all any important or outstanding significant events in the years that you had been involved in trucking in this area that stand out in your mind as maybe not historical, but maybe humorous?
I don't remember anything too historical. I think it was always great when we purchased another company, extended our operating authority, which we did many, many times, because most of our growth was really by small and numerous purchases over the years. To think that we were successful enough to continue to grow and have the capital to step forward and make the next purchase and the next purchase and the next purchase. Although I have no desire to ever go back to the East Coast like we did in 1968. Of course, I guess I'm getting too old now. I don't know as I have any desire to get any larger than we are. I think we are a large company now. I think we're around 51st in size in the U.S. And the corridor that we serve, if you ever take a look at a map, is the most highly industrial part of the United States. Our authority is just an excellent authority.
The upper Midwest, or?
Well, as I stated before, with Syracuse on the east and Chicago on the west and down south to Birmingham and Atlanta and all that area in between.
Right.
You've really got some coverage. Just thinking over the years that one thing that hasn't changed very much, no, two things. We're paying today basically about the same amount of money for a gallon of gasoline that we did 35 years ago.
Even with the gas?
No, I don't include the taxes. I said basically, or the base price. And it's almost true of tires. Tire prices have not increased significantly over all those years.
That's interesting.
There's been some taxes go on, but I'm talking about the base price of the tire. Has not really gone way, way out like so many things, like trucks, for example.
How have the tires changed at all, or are they?
Well, tires, of course, have made the changes in tires have all been for the good. And as I mentioned earlier, just prior to my time, of course, they had hard rubber tires, but those things blew out too. Actually, when they blow, I mean that they went off of the rim.
Mm-hmm. What was the base price of a tire and gasoline when you originally started, as opposed to now, you recall?
Well, I think at that time that gasoline was about 10 cents a gallon. And basically, it's not an awful lot higher than that today, to us in bulk
mm-hmm.
purchases. You know, it's almost beyond imagination, but I can remember one time Mr. Blair saying to me, good many years ago, talking about another company, he says, you know, they wear out a set of tires every 24 hours. And I thought, boy, that's really something. We wear out more than a set of tires here every 24 hours. Of course, we have over 20,000 tires running every day. It's, you know, it just... what growth does to you, and
right.
It gets enormous, and you just can't sometimes imagine. A tire today, a tire tube and rim, will run in the neighborhood of $100, and 25 years ago, it was about the same price. We use in Cincinnati, for example, which is our main break point in our north-south operation, because a driver domiciled in Cincinnati can go to any point that we serve in one tour duty or in 10 hours driving time. But we pump 10,000 gallons of diesel fuel in Cincinnati every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of fuel. That's a lot of fuel, you know.
Right.
You don't realize, I guess, how big you are until you stop to put some of these things together, and it makes you realize a lot of miles involved there when you wear out more than a set of tires, or a lot of miles when in just one place you will pump 10,000 gallons of diesel fuel one day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
There's three pumps down there in those check-through lanes, and they are all manned 24 hours a day with people doing nothing but fueling vehicles and checking oil and checking the radiators and hitting the tires with a hammer and fixing the lights, and the way they go. We try to put one unit through a lane each 12 minutes down there.
Mm-hmm.
And about the only time we ever get closed down there is Christmas and New Year's, and that would be just maybe closed for 12 to 16 hours. We don't even get closed for the whole day. That's the difference between a long-haul operation that we're getting involved in and the old short-haul operation where, like 25 years ago, basically every driver was home every day because he drove at night. And then when we got into the Chicago operation and the Cleveland and that, well, of course, it got so the drivers made a one-way trip and went to bed for their rest. Back in about 1950, Dow Chemical had worked out to ship much of their foreign material from what then was known as the Dow Dock in Bay City, which just prior to that served as a inbound place for ships to come in and unload coal. And Dow then had that coal loaded in train cars and hauled to Midland for their source of power. But anyway, they started shipping via truck, and Blair Transit was the one and only carrier at that time, and we handled many, many, many loads from April through the middle of November to the port of Bay City to load on foreign ships to go to foreign countries. I recall most of it going to Rotterdam. And of course that has grown since that time much, much more. And Great Lakes Express is not the sole carrier on that now, and shouldn't be. There's at least two carriers involved in it, and the tonnage is split somewhat by Dow. So that was a first over there for us, and I know it has been very, very beneficial. Back at about that time, I recall that Dow had even talked about the loading of barges and by damming of the Tibidawasi River, and it had talked about barging materials all the way from Midland to Chicago via the Tibidawasi, Saginaw River, Saginaw Bay, and the lakes.
You spoke of barging there. Thought came to my mind about the piggyback system by the train route. Does Great Lakes Express use that? When did they start it, if they do?
Well, we use it very, very little. We have used it when we had an abnormal flow of traffic, perhaps in one direction, and we would use it to move the loads down and move empty trailers back, or we have used it to balance trailer supply when a terminal, for some unknown reason, perhaps because a big customer moved and a terminal would end up with excess trailers, we would move the trailers to another location by piggyback. But piggyback has done real well. We mentioned Dow at Midland. Dow loads many, many piggyback loads per day, and this was a lot of this freight was freight that was hauled by common carrier over the roads previously. But by the same token, their overall volume has increased. So even though we've lost piggyback, we still may be hauling more tons. Of course, we haul more tons per vehicle, too.
I think we're just about